Welcome to World History After 1500, Episode 3, The Discoveries. In 1492, the world consisted of a couple of compartments, dense clusters of humanity, which in Afro-Asia, as some historians now call it, that is, Eurasian mass, landmass, and those parts of Africa that were linked to it, were vaguely aware of each other's existence, but they had practically no direct contacts. The typical system of trade, until the 16th century, was a system of interlocking scales, that is, gateway ports, where one civilization interacted with another, yet they were not in direct contact with their continental hinterlands, thus Aleppo or Alexandria, where Phoenician or Catalan traders would meet Arab and Turkish merchants. Those merchants dealt with Indian or Southeast Asian merchants, in turn, in places like Ceylon and Kerala, or at the furthest point in Malacca. There, in turn, these merchants might meet Chinese traders. Again, Italian or Castilian merchants might trade in places like Ceuta or Tunis. The Arab merchants, who might then trade across the Sahara to Timbuktu or to Suku, where in turn they might encounter merchants from West Africa. However, all these groups were not in direct touch with one another. They were old and important contacts, all right, but most of what the groups knew about the next group was hearsay. Thus, for example, while Italian or Catalan merchants were very familiar with Morocco, virtually all information they had about the interior of Africa until the early 19th century derived from only one text, the Descripción de l'Africa, written by the Moroccan judge Ibn Muhammad al-Wasan al-Arabi, who, after he was captured by Christian pirates, converted to Christianity and who adopted the name of Leo Africanus. Al-Wasan al-Arabi had been Moroccan envoy to the West African Songhai Empire, and he had thus detailed information about anything touching the Songhai. Europeans, however, though they were present on the African coast, merely knew Songhai as a distant name. Europeans had fake knowledge of anything beyond the scales. They knew places beyond that existed, but that was about it. Illustration to this episode is, for example, a map from 1300, drawn in Constantinople, so probably drafted in close consultation with Arab merchants, who had the most accurate knowledge of the world. And the map thus shows the most accurate scientific data about the world available in 1300. If we look at that map, note first that the Europeans had a pretty accurate knowledge of the Red Sea, and that they were more or less aware of the existence of Ethiopia. Beyond that, however, they had merely fake notions about the existence of Africa, but they knew little about it. And as good scholars, the man making the map more or less suspended judgment. For West Africa, their knowledge extended no further than the Niger. The common idea was, at the time, that the Niger and the Nile were linked. They were in close contact with the cities on the Niger, and had some fake notions of the rest of West Africa. But they had no idea whatsoever of what was to the south of it. The common conception at the time was actually that the Indian Ocean was landlocked. In Asia, notice that the size of Sri Lanka is much exaggerated. In my view, since this map is a merchant projection, and Sri Lanka was an important entrepot to this trade, so that merchants tended to dramatically exaggerate its size. Note furthermore, that they had a pretty good idea of the Straits of Malacca, but as to East Asia, their knowledge did not extend much further than Canton, because that was the final place Arabs traded with. Now this was of course changed in the 15th and 16th century, as the Spaniards achieved the first system of planetary links, in a process that used to be called the Discovery, or some historians would now prefer to call early modern globalization. Though I personally do not like the latter term very much, as it suggests parallels between the now and then that are on the face of it absurd, the term discoveries is obviously a bit strange too. Strictly speaking, the true discoveries had taken place much earlier, as humanity spread from Africa across the rest of the globe, and that those true discoveries were actually just over with the settlement of New Zealand around 1000 Common Era. Except a few tiny islands, the entire globe had been discovered already in the age of the discoveries. In fact, the fact that wherever they went, they encountered humans already struck the discoverers themselves as odd, and forced Spanish clergymen to reconsider the biblical claim all humans were derived from Adam. On the face of it then, you might as well claim the Taino of Haiti discovered Columbus, rather than that Columbus discovered the Taino. It's all a matter of perspective. In this respect, the term early modern globalization seems appropriate. The difference between Columbus' discovery of the Taino and the Taino's discovery of Columbus was that Columbus diffused their existence to Europe, and from there on to the rest of Eurasia. The Ottoman Turks, for example, were by 1500 well aware America existed, and one of the best early maps of America was actually drawn by an Ottoman admiral, Piri Reis, in 1513. On the other hand, however, when the Taino discovered Columbus, they diffused the existence of Europe only to other Taino. Though there were some seaborne contacts between Yucatan and the Caribbean, the Aztecs or the Mayas would have been spared infinite trouble had they had some information from the Taino about those strange white people with their beards and all their hair that were appearing on their shore. What is even more striking is that when Francisco Pizarro appeared, the Incas had no information whatsoever about what had happened to the Aztecs 8 years before. In this respect, the Spanish discovered the Americas more than that the Americans discovered the Spanish. One is almost tempted to say, if only the Americans had discovered the Spanish, because in that case, to speculate, the Incas might, for example, have called on the Turks to aid them with troops against the Spanish, much as Ethiopia, that was a part of the old world diplomatic system, could call on the Portuguese to aid them with an expeditionary force to stem Turkish advances in Ethiopia. Now there are two questions that are commonly asked about the discoveries. The first one has become nearly a commonplace in any world historical curriculum, and it is a fact too that is mentioned in almost any world historic textbook, namely, that had things turned out only slightly differently, the Chinese might well have discovered Europe, and one then commonly refers to the 7 expeditions the Ming Emperor Zhongli sent out on the command of the Muslim eunuch Zheng He to reconnoiter the Western Seas, as the Chinese called them, from 1405 to 1424. These expeditions reached as far as Kilwa in East Africa, maybe even to Madagascar, 6,000 kilometers from China, while the Portuguese had just in the same period managed to brave Cabo Bojador, 900 kilometers from Portugal. Again, it is almost commonplace now to lay a picture of Zheng He's mighty flagship next to Columbus' Santa Maria. And compared to that, Columbus' ship is clearly a rowboat. On returning from his last voyage, new emperor Hongzhi, however, ordered Zheng He's fleet to be laid up and any further voyages to be discontinued. And yet, the picture of Zheng He's mighty flagship compared to Columbus's tiny rowboat leaves me with the small and the big question. The small question is whether a ship that size would have been seaworthy. Indeed, whether it would have floated at all. And it makes me wonder whether the entire model may not be based on some chronicle that is stating a kind of Mickey Mouse figure on size, the kind of Mickey Mouse figures I've been warning against in the last lecture. The big question is that were we to lay Zheng He's mighty ship next to a Portuguese galleon used in the late 16th century, it would not seem that big. Now, Portuguese galleons were so big because they had to transport heavy bulk cargo, and above all, as they were used to transport troops. The officers of whom at least needed some space to live with the quorum. For it almost belies imagination how very cramped sailing ships were. To a common sailor, your entire personal space was your hammock. Officers, however, at least needed a cabin. And similarly, Zheng He used that bigger ship since he needed to convey troops and cargo, whereas Columbus's Santa Maria was a light, cheap ship that was especially built for easy navigation with as small a crew as possible, as the Santa Maria was intended to chart unknown waters. Well, Zheng He's ships were sailing well known, or at least somewhat known waters, much as was the case for the galleons in the late 16th century. In other words, however large the distance covered by Zheng He, Zheng He's voyages were not truly voyages of discovery, as he featured no further than waters the Chinese were broadly familiar with. Whereas, when Sheila Janisch rounded Cabo Bojador d'Or, he was sailing waters at least the Portuguese were completely unfamiliar with, however much closer Cabo Bojador d'Or might have been to Portugal. Now, although the Emperor Hongzhi ordered the maps and the papers relating to Zheng He's voyage destroyed too, there is one account remaining of Zheng He's voyages, namely Mahuan Tingzhai Xinla, translating in English as Survey of the Ocean Shore. Or if I compare that text with the contemporary Portuguese chronicle Janisch de Zurara, that similarly quoted voyages to far-off lands, two things are striking. And those two things, I think, reflect basic differences between the Chinese and the Europeans, or really the Portuguese. First, and most obviously, while Mahuan faithfully records information on the religion of the inhabitants, it might not even have occurred to him that the Chinese should convert them to the true religion. The tone of Mahuan is, oh, how weird those local customs. But if inhabitants have those strange customs, let them stick to it. The idea that they were committing idolatry, blasphemy, or conversing with the devil with their odd religion would not even have occurred to him. The Chinese, in other words, lacked the major motivation that was driving the Iberians, namely, that they had to spread the word of Christ to all four corners of the world. Furthermore, Mahuan records the aim of Zheng He's voyage as follows, quote, "In the fifth year, Xuan Te, an order was respectfully received from our imperial court that the principal envoy, the great eunuch Zheng He, and others should go to all foreign countries to read out imperial commands and bestow rewards." and he pursued. When a division of the fleet reached the country of Kuli, of course it's called in modern Kerala, the grand eunuch saw that his country was sending men to travel there. Whereupon he selected an interpreter and others, 7 men in all, and he sent them with a lot of musk and other such things, and they joined a ship of this country, and they went to China. It took them 1 year to go and return. They brought all kinds of unusual commodities and rare valuables. In addition, they painted an accurate representation of the heavenly Lord, and then they returned content to the capital. In other words, the prime aim of Zheng He's voyages was to encourage merchants to come to China, perhaps encourage Chinese merchants to trade on foreign lands. But the very idea that China might found factories manned by officials of the Chinese Empire in foreign lands would have struck Ma Huan as for, whereas foreigners needed Chinese goods, porcelain, silk, and so on, China did not really need the foreigners. Spain and Portugal, on the other hand, were in vital need of foreign products, as in fact was Europe at large. And in particular, they knew 2 things, and for the former product, the Spanish had in fact such a thirst that the Indian thought it was a kind of Spanish disease, spices and gold. Now the reason why Europe had such an enormous need for spices is rather easy to understand. Basically, at the beginning of winter, Europeans had to slaughter part of their cattle as the stables for winter in October and November were too small. Europeans thus had huge stocks of meat, and on these huge stocks of meat they had to rely for the entire winter. As there were obviously no refrigerators, this meant that, even if the meat had been salted, Europeans had during the winter to eat putrid or rotten meat. And the only way of disguising the putrid smell and foul taste of that meat was to throw lots of spices on it. Medieval cookbooks thus described the application of quantities of spices to food, but that would make any modern reader vomit by the thought of it. As to cold, the problem that became increasingly acute during the late 14th century was that Europe paid for its exchange of those spices with gold and silver, and up to the 15th century mostly with silver from mines in Kutahora, in the modern Czech Republic. But that by the early 15th century, the supply from those mines began to run out, whereas, furthermore, precious metals were increasingly used in circulation within Europe itself. So that by the early 15th century, Europe experienced an acute shortage of precious metals, both silver and gold. Both the price of and the demand for precious metals thus soared. The Chinese had no particularly pressing need to go discovering the world, as the world was only too glad onto China. Europeans, on the other hand, were critically short of several products. And as important, the Chinese had no motivation to spread their religion. These were the 2 salient motives for the discoveries, to which may be added the soaring demand for sugar in Europe, that in China was largely supplied from within China. The second common question about the discoveries is why they were headed by such a small, such a poor, such an insignificant country perched on the very edge of Europe as Portugal. Now first, the idea that Portugal was on the edge of Europe is an illusion produced by modern maps. Ever since Genoese ships had started directly sailing to the Flemish entrepôt of Bruges in 1342, Lisbon, which was exactly halfway, had become a major entrepot by itself, rather than laying in the middle of nowhere. It was in fact astride one of Europe's main trade routes. It was, rather than on the edge of Europe, in the middle of Europe. Furthermore, the term small country is a modern term. By medieval terms, Portugal was a middle-sized state, comparable to the international rank of France or Britain nowadays. Now, the reason why voyages of discovery were headed first by Portugal, and Portugal was later on then joined by Spain, after a considerable period of Spanish pirates preying on Portuguese shipping, commonly the preparation for overseas ventures in the early modern period. The Dutch, the English, and the French, after all started as pirates too, is at once very simple and it is very complicated. The simple reason is that the Atlantic is dominated by two wind systems, westerly winds, blowing at tropical latitudes, and easterly winds, blowing at northern latitudes. And the closest to these westerly winds are Spain and Portugal, while both the Azores and the Canary Islands are within these westerly wind systems. If you want to sail to the Americas from Europe, the easiest way to do so is to part from the southern tip of Portugal or from Andalusia, then sail on to the Azores or to the Canary Islands, and from there sail west. But if you came from northwestern Europe, you still had to brave the Bay of Biscay, a notoriously dangerous stretch of water. For the same reason, sailing to America from Spain became centralized in Andalusia in the south, rather than Galicia, let alone Barcelona. Because while it would seem the small distance to Galicia, or the small distance on to Barcelona, would not matter a great deal if you had just traversed the entire Atlantic. Actually, most shipwrecks on the Havana, Sofia route occurred on the last few days of the journey, on the moment you had nearly reached Spain, off the Spanish coast. In addition to which, Spain and Portugal had a very difficult relationship in the early 16th century, and the Spanish crown did not really want to hazard its ships of Portugal. As to going to Barcelona, you then had to pass Gibraltar, and the passage across Gibraltar was beset by Moroccan pirates and privateers. Furthermore, the Portuguese were familiar with the waters between Portugal and at least modern Mauritania before 1425, as they had long been fishing off the Moroccan coast. So, the Portuguese were not only closest to the westerly winds, but also the ones most familiar with these winds. This long-term engagement of the Portuguese with fishing obviously also meant that the Portuguese had an enormous reservoir of expert and experienced mariners at hand, which are far less so for Castile, where the main maritime provinces were in the north, in Galicia. The Basques in particular were famous sailors. The Southerners, the Andalusians, on the other hand, were landlubbers. This is actually still the case in Spain. San Sebastian has the largest fishing fleet of all of Europe. The Catalans, on the other hand, had long sailed in the Mediterranean, but had almost no experience with the Atlantic. There is, however, also a far more complicated reason for the discoveries. It is always necessary to recall that the Portuguese discoveries precisely coincided with one of the most grim periods in all of European history. All of Europe, then, appeared to be tearing itself apart in internecine feuds between the kings, between the nobility, between the nobles and the commoners, and indeed in feuds where nobody knew at all what the point of fighting was. Thus in England, the nobility first fell on the battlefields of the interminable Hundred Years' War, and then it tore itself apart in the War of the Roses, whereas the Netherlands were also torn asunder by an endless feud
between various parties in the country of Holland. It is called the Hoekse en Kabeljauwse Twister. While in the German Empire, virtually any knight had declared himself independent. Somebody from the outside, looking at Europe, in 1431, when Jeanne d'Arc, a contemporary Henry the Navigator, was burnt on the stake, could be forgiven for thinking that Europe was in a state of profound decline. Except the kingdoms of Portugal and Castile, which virtually alone managed to avoid the fighting between opposing factions that was such a prominent feature of that period. That is partly, I think, because Portugal and Spain could divert the energies of the junior nobles who were thirsting for glory in tournaments and better still on the battlefield, away to external enemies. In Castile's case, that's obviously the Reconquista on the Muslims. And in the Portuguese case, after the Kingdom of Castile had basically refused Portugal any further right to participate in the Reconquista, to ventures in Morocco. That started with the conquest of Ceuta in 1415. When the Portuguese succeeded from Spain in 1640, Ceuta was the only Portuguese possession that sided with Spain, and therefore Ceuta has remained a Spanish possession to this very day. And later on, the Portuguese fostered two enterprises further to the south. That is perhaps the reason of the peculiar tendency in Portuguese chronicles to term any African they encounter a Moor, though the Portuguese were likely well aware they were not Muslim. Nobles pretend they were doing Reconquista in Senegal or Mauritania. For if in the second phase of the Conquista in the Americas, and earlier on already during the Portuguese exploration of the coast of Africa, the officials of the crown, the merchants, and hesitantly even some great international capitalist firms began to step in, and in the Americas of course the clergy, the social group driving the Spanish conquest of the Americas, Portuguese conquests in Asia, was the junior nobility. That is, the squires, as they were called in England. That is, persons who had the noble title, page of the king, junior knight, lord of the hamlet, such and such, who had the noble pedigree, who had the shield of arms, but were not important enough to be part of the direct retinue of the king, and who disposed of what they called a manor, which was commonly no more than a small house. If you go and eat with the noble, better take your own food along, as they said in Spain. These nobles were sons of somebody, as the Portuguese term fidalgo literally means. They were quite unlike commoner nobodies, yet they might in fact be poorer than them. This is a type of human being that is well enough known from a book listeners ought to have read, Don Quixote de la Mancha. Now Don Quixote's mind had of course been poisoned by reading too many chivalric novels and late medieval chivalric poems, such as the fantastic adventure book, we might nowadays call it Knight and Magic, the noble and chivalric deeds of the knight Amadis de Gaula, the bestseller in 16th century Spain. What is most stunning in retrospect is that supreme quality of self-confidence of the conquistadors, which can perhaps best be explained by them having modeled their entire life and their entire perception of reality on the chivalric novels, such as the Amadis. Just like Don Quixote madly dashed at a flock of sheep without ever thinking about the consequences, they too dashed forward. No matter how often you look at it, there remains something surreal about the sheer daring do of the conquistadors. Thus, for instance, Hernán Cortés, during his entire conquest of Mexico, acted in direct contravention of the representative of the Spanish crown, the governor of Cuba, Diego Velázquez de Villar. He was, in fact, little more than a mutineer throughout, so that throughout his expedition, he had constantly to struggle with descent within his own ranks. With his barely 630 men, who were all the time quarreling amongst each other, and constantly had to face the possibility they were going to end up on the gallows, Cortes then still marched forward to face an Aztec army that consisted at least of 40,000 men. Again, the event at Cajamarca of 16 November 1532 may range among the most stunning cases of bluff in all of human history. An expedition of a mere 180 men under Francisco Pizarro marches into the middle of an at least 20,000 strong army of Inca Atahualpa and then literally ransoms Atahualpa in the middle of his own army. Although, as we now know, his troops had actually received orders from Atahualpa not to engage in hostilities. They meekly followed orders and were completely butchered by Pizarro and his party. The older explanation of the collapse of the Incas and the Aztecs, best known in the English-speaking countries through the classic works of William Prescott, was to perceive it as a war of the worlds, in terms of a classic science fiction novel of Herbert Wells from 1898, which at least should be familiar to listeners from a recent film with Tom Cruise. In fact, a passage in that book says that the Martians of Wells behaved in precisely the same way as the Spaniards did in the New World. They similarly mercilessly wiped out any resistance of Earthlings. And War of the Worlds is arguably intended as a kind of parallel of how in 1900 it was thought that the Aztecs perceived the Spaniards, except surely for the happy end, where Earthly bacteria wipe out the Martians, while in the Americas, Old World bacteria wiped out the Aztecs even before the conquest, and even more rapidly during the conquest. In fact, the Aztec resistance during the siege of Tenochtitlan broke down because Aztec defenders were utterly ravaged by epidemics. Otherwise, except the happy ending then, the two stories run parallel. Much like the Earthlings were completely paralyzed by invading Martians, so too the Incas and the Aztecs were completely paralyzed by invading Spanish aliens, whom they had no way of placing into the mental universe, whose motives they did not grasp, and any resistance against whom, at any rate, was useless. Spanish were as far ahead of the Aztecs and the Incas as the Martians were to the Earthlings, to which at least in the Spanish Aztec case should be added the Quetzalcoatl myth, in which the Spaniards were supposedly perceived by the Aztecs as gods. That story belongs to popular folklore, but it is likely a later invention of the Spanish themselves, and since the Spaniards, at any rate, lusted after any woman, these women could in effect have told the menfolk that the Spaniards were clearly men. Of the past decades, mainly based on Nahuatl and Maya sources that were not available to Prescott, a rather different and a far more down-to-earth picture has emerged. Another illustration of my previous point that there is real progress in. Now, it is critical to remember that both the Aztec and the Inca Empire were very recent creations, and that most very recently subdued people detested the Aztecs, who had, after all, sacrificed them by the thousands, and they were seeking an occasion to throw off the Aztec and also the Inca yoke. The conquistadors had plenty of local auxiliaries available, auxiliaries who were thirsting for a first opportunity to settle scores with the Aztecs. While the Incas were in the middle of a civil war between two contenders to the Inca throne, Atahualpa and Huáscar. And Atahualpa seems to have hoped he could enlist the Spanish as useful allies to fight Huáscar, while in Montezuma's policy seems to have been to stem a possible dangerous coalition between the Spanish and the Aztec rivals, Tlaxcala in particular. Even after Montezuma's policy had obviously failed, and he had been replaced by an anti-Spanish coalition, the Aztecs were still hampered, not so much by their inferior weaponry, as rather by the way they perceived war. They saw war as a strictly ritual and ritualized affair, to be conducted at an auspicious time. And the aim of war was not so much to kill people, at first to knock them unconscious, then take them prisoner, and then to sacrifice them. And the Aztecs had not the time to adjust to the Spanish way of war, which revolved, and that was certainly the case for a bunch of desperate men,
as were Cortés and his band of outlaws, around killing as many people as quickly as possible, a way of fighting that the Aztecs saw as barbaric, just as the Spanish saw the Aztec flower wars as barbaric. Finally, the expectation of certainly Tlaxcalans appears simply to have been to use the Spaniards as useful allies, and that they would remain in charge. All this is, as said, a rather more down-to-earth vision than the magnificent War of the Worlds vision. It is, however, also a more plausible one, as this would nicely fit in with so many other cases, such as the conquest of Africa during the age of modern imperialism, with which I shall deal later, or indeed, as it fits in with the contemporary Portuguese conquest of Asia, where, to put it all in a nutshell, the Portuguese are mostly seen as, and enlisted as, useful allies by local rulers, often local rulers who were trying to get rid of the burdensome yoke of some more powerful ruler. The Portuguese were then in reward allotted the right to build a stronghold within such a ruler's territory, provided all the rest of it remained under his rule. Sometimes there were allotted some villages too, with subject peasants, provided they then assisted him or her in times of war. It seems that it was also pretty much how the Mesoamericans initially perceived the Spanish. They could build a few new cities, but power in the countryside would remain firmly in the hands of local Aztec or Tlaxcalan chiefs and small rulers, whom the Spanish called caciques, and who indeed, until the very end of colonial rule, still largely derived from the old Aztec or Tlaxcalan aristocracy. They would grant the Spanish some taxes, in return for which the Spaniards would then allow them to administer their own affairs. In fact, it seems as if the Spanish initially perceived matters in more or less the same way. The standard way of exploitation of the New World was the encomienda system, which was more or less patterned on Spain's earlier colonial conquests in Islamic southern Spain. The idea here was that the crown granted you a charter or letter patent, with which you obtained a piece of land with Islamic peasants on it. These peasants would remain under their own village head and had to give part of their taxes to their new Christian landlord. It was then the responsibility of the encomendiero to pay and maintain a couple of soldiers, who normally had to ensure subject peasants did pay their taxes and occasionally had to assist in some war of the King of Castile. And they had, of course, to convert these Muslims too. But as Christian peasants were far better protected by the church, most landlords were not in a particular hurry to do so. Therefore, as late as 1583, a fact far too often ignored by English-speaking historians, up to a quarter of all inhabitants of southern Spain were Moriscos, that is, peasants or craftsmen who outdoor behaved as if they were Christians, but indoors remained Muslim throughout. Actually, the existence of the Moriscos, and not, as is often assumed, English-speaking historians persecuting the Jews, was the reason why Spain established its own branch of the Inquisition, which in Spain, by the way, was a branch of the state and not, as elsewhere, of the church. And it is also fascinating that 120 years after the establishment of the Inquisition, the Moriscos were still there. To refer to the Americas, the original intention of the Spanish crown was that the Spaniards would similarly sit on the manor, collect taxes, and then occasionally contribute a few soldiers to pacify the surroundings. That is, until about 1540 to 1560, an Aztec society basically began to collapse all around the Spaniards. The result was twofold. On the one hand, small manorial lords were gradually swallowed by big manorial lords, so that land in Mexico increasingly became concentrated in the hands of a few hundred families. And this was, of course, to remain so until the Mexican Revolution of 1906. On the other hand, landlords began to diversify. By 1600, the typical pattern in central and northern Mexico had become the hacienda, that is, an almost self-sufficient agricultural estate, which had then further portfolios in cattle ranching, in mining, or in trade. Though this is, to repeat, typical for central and to an extent northern Mexico. In southern Mexico, Indian village communities remained completely intact. Thus, for example, in the province of Chiapas, which in the 1990s gave rise to the worldwide admired Zapatista movement, basically a movement of native peasants who defended their rights to the soil, from which they had not, as in northern central Mexico, been deprived from or expulsed from in the 16th century. Now, this disintegration of Mexican society, and the same took place but much more slowly in Peru, as in Peru far less Spaniards established themselves than was the case in Mexico. And another reason was that Indian resistance in Peru was far longer lasting and far more stubborn than it was in Mexico, partly as a result of which the Indian communities also were protected by the Spanish crown far more than was the case in Mexico. This collapse had three causes, and each of which usefully serves to demonstrate a wider point. The least important were Spanish cruelties, and this despite the denunciation of these cruelties in a book that has become large typical anti-colonial pamphlet ever since, and that was later on used by the Dutch to argue that since the Spaniards had behaved cruelly towards the Indians, the Spanish crown had forfeited any right to proclaim itself lord over the Americas. Dominican friars and first bishop of Santo Domingo, Bartolomé de las Casas, Brevissimo Relación de la Destrucción de las Indias, has said, "This has proven to be one of the most influential books of the early modern period, since the English and the Dutch used it to elaborate what Spaniards later called black legends." And discussions on the Brevissimo Relación have endured ever since. Pro-Spanish writers plead that the figures de las Casas mentions, 1.2 million Indians killed, are all horrendous exaggerations. And anti-Spanish writers say these figures were partly right. Now, 1.2 million may seem like a lot, but if we recall the 800,000 people killed during the Rwanda genocide in the 90s, it does not seem all too far-fetched. For after all, the Rwanda genocide too was an enormous number of killings achieved by entirely pre-industrial means, knives, machetes. Here is a quote from Las Casas to show what I mean. "The Spaniards forced their way into the native settlements. They slaughtered everyone they found there, small children, old men, pregnant women. They hacked them to pieces. They sliced their belly open. They even laid wagers on whom could slice a man in one stroke, or disembowel them with a single stroke of an axe. It's all exactly like Rwanda. And the figure of 1 million killed does not seem that far off the mark. However, both the Vatican, which repeatedly protested against the maltreatment of Indians, and the Spanish Crown did indeed listen to de las Casas' pleas on behalf of the Indians. And from as early as 1512 onward, the Spanish Crown began to emit an ever more comprehensive and an ever more elaborate legislation to protect the Indians against the worst Spanish extortions and rapes and murders, the so-called La Indígena. You were obviously not guaranteed success if you did so. But if, as an Indian woman, by 1580, you were raped by a Spanish landlord, you might still appeal to Spanish Audiencia. It might, if you could prove your case, perhaps find the landlord. It was far from a perfect system. But it bears repetition that in North America, Native Americans were entirely beyond the law. Far more devastating, therefore, were two other processes. That Spaniards, with the then available knowledge of medicine and biology, though noting, were utterly unable to stem or to combat. For the medical knowledge, the Spaniards were then not far ahead of the Aztecs, namely a combination of intrusive species and outward diseases, which historian Alfred Cosby, whom I mentioned already as a big historian, together labeled the Columbian Exchange. The Spaniards brought an entire ecology with them from the old world, plants, animals, microbes, and other ways of tilling the soil as well. An entire complex that devastated the ecology of the Americas in such a way that, to mention just one case, which I found chilling, we now have to reconstruct the way of farming of the Taino, and indeed the entire ecosystem in which they lived, from archaeological digs. Since both their farms and their entire pre-Columbian flora and fauna have been buried under an entirely different ecosystem and a system of farming that in Haiti was imported from Africa and came with slaves there. This is actually fairly typical of the entire Caribbean, a transplanted Africa on top of a vanished Indian population and Indian ecosystem. Though obviously, this is far less so elsewhere. Although, for example, all cash crops grown in modern Guatemala, except in coca, that's native, cotton, coffee, bananas, are imports from India, Arabia and New Guinea, the way in which subsistence farmers till the soil there has not changed at all since the Maya, except that they use iron tools nowadays. The first problem was that of invasive species, that is, are plants or animals that are not native to a specific location. They have tendency to spread, and that causes damage to the environment, the human economy, and human health. For almost as soon as the Spaniards landed, they started importing animals and crops without which they could simply not imagine life as civilized human beings. When Spanish geography in Latin America starts any description of any place with stating how many orange trees grew there, and the more oranges, the better. The Spaniards thus tried transforming Peru into Andalusia, for the orange was a plant originally derived from India and not native to the New World at all. Note, by the way, that the orange trees are one useful legacy of the mission stations the Spaniards established in the 18th century in California. Though it yielded far less than maize, and plowing devastated soil, the Spaniards still insisted on growing grain in the Americas, since, after all, Christ is reincarnated in a piece of bread, and not in a tortilla. Now all these useful crops, and above all these useful animals to the Spaniards, turned invasive species in the Americas. The example with which Americans are probably most familiar is the Mustang, the living symbol of the historic and pioneer spirit of the West, as the US Congress recently designated them. The Mustang derives from Iberian war horses, which the conquistadors brought to northern Mexico to fight the Comanches and the Apaches, and they began to proliferate in the wild of the Great American Prairies, returning to their origins before they were domesticated as a species, except that the Mustang is much bigger than its closest kin in Eurasia, the Przewalski horse. Since the Przewalski horse shares its original ecosystem in Siberia with a great many other species, whereas the Mustang does not. Strictly speaking, therefore, whatever its role in American culture, the Mustang is a pest. Very similarly, other species brought by the Spanish to the Americas also proliferated wildly, and they began to eat the crops of the Aztecs, to which the Aztecs at first had no protection whatsoever, since the Americas lacked the animals which would have eaten them in Eurasia, and they were not used to fence their land off to protect against these invasive species. It's a whole series of species, all ran wild, and all utterly devastated Aztec agriculture. Rats, sheep, pigs, and goats. By 1600, large parts of central Mexico that had once supported dense populations had completely reverted to pastures. In addition to which, I should mention the cow, which proliferated in northern Mexico and even more in the grasslands of southern Brazil and in Argentina. The cow there reverted to its origins in the European Wiesent, and cows became dangerous herd animals, which ravaged the Indian populations of the Pampa. Similarly, in Haiti, in the 17th century, Spanish cattle also ran wild, and it formed large herds that were chased by cowboys, partly for selling salted meat to ships, partly to eat the meat. In Jamaica, this dish is called jerk meat, national dish. They cook that on an oven. Such an oven is by a Taino word known as bucan, and these people were therefore called bucaniers. Even more devastating, however, were the microbes the Europeans brought with them from Europe, not even to mention the pigs they also brought with them. For humans are genetically very close to pigs, and many human diseases are transmitted by pigs, diseases to which the pigs have an immune system, but humans have not. Historians have been quarreling for decades on what all these diseases were, for the Spaniards were, if they were familiar with the diseases, not very precise in naming them, but it surely included an endless array of European, Asian, and African diseases brought there by the slaves, like smallpox, cholera, malaria, and even such seemingly innocent European diseases like measles. To Europeans who have an immune system to measles, that is a child disease. But right up to the 1960s, measles killed thousands upon thousands in the Amazon, where the inhabitants are not immune to measles. The effects of the microbes can best be compared to those of a nuclear bomb. In 1492, there were probably 1 million people living in Haiti. In 1534, there were only 200 left. The population of central Mexico dropped from 25 million to 2 million in 1630, that of Peru from 8 to less than a million. The owners of the encomienda and the crown's tax gatherers thus saw the tributary population dwindle under their very eyes, without them being able to do anything about it. Now, to truly appreciate the effects of all this on the Native Americans, it must be remembered first that the intricate cosmology they had developed over thousands of years had no answer to this entire collapse of their society. If people were dying all around them, was that in some way a punishment of the gods? What sense did all that make? So that on the one hand, The trust of the population in their chiefs or priests collapsed, who were after all completely unable to explain what was happening to them, while, even more inexplicably for the Indians, the number of Spanish multiplied, and it kept on multiplying, while they were dying in droves. The only obvious conclusion was that the gods had forsaken them, and that there must be something right to that god man the missionaries were always talking about. Though the last leader of anti-Spanish resistance in Peru, Manco Inca, might say that Jesus Christ was merely some paint on a piece of linen, and that the Inca gods, the sun and the moon, were plain to see to anybody. Now, having talked about the Americas, what were the effects of the discoveries elsewhere? First of all, if you lived on the African Great Lakes, the news that some white devils were roaming the coast, who rode on butterflies, you might have deemed an interesting tale or a legend from lands very far away. It was only with the increasing expansion of the slave trade into the interior of Africa in the late 18th and above all in the 19th century that Europe began to have some impact on the deep interior. In West Africa in the 15th century, in my impression, which had long contact with the Arabs after all, the Portuguese were seen as just another group of Arabs. Just as they had been doing with the Arabs before, the Portuguese were assigned by African chiefs or kings a plot of land, where they could then build a house, and which they could use to store the products they had for exchange. Initially alcohol, heavy Flemish textiles, I've never understood why the Africans would want that, but mainly Austrian copper, that they then bartered for gold, which had not much use in West Africa, since it was not used as currency, and guinea pepper, piri piri as it's now called. That's an indispensable ingredient for spicing up the otherwise rather bland cuisine of West Africa, but is not really that valuable a product. Four, although the Africans were not as well armed as the Europeans, there were lots of Africans there, and very few Europeans, never more than a few hundred. And the extreme unhealthiness of the place, only one in four Europeans survived their very first year there, the big killer being the particularly lethal malaria of West Africa, made conquering the place not very enticing to Europeans too. Until the 19th century, the Europeans sat in West Africa at the complete mercy of African kings, and they commonly had only fake notions of anything a few miles beyond the coast. Yet the discoveries had a major impact on Europe. Geographer James Blount argued that the great divergence, the process by which Europe, that had so far been more or less equal to Asia, and arguably even to Africa, though I doubt that, began with the discoveries. And though we would have to set the true date of the Great Divergence much later, in the 19th century, as I will argue later on, it is certainly not wrong to say that the discoveries heralded a process in which Europe increasingly began to diverge from the cultural and economic norm of other civilizations. A norm the Dutch historian Jan Romein called the common human pattern, in several ways. First, there is the idea of progress. Now, agrarian civilizations tend to be profoundly conservative. This is easy to understand, given that a pattern of thought basically reflects the agricultural process. In agriculture, since after all, for your very survival, you depend on crops, it is extremely risky to depart from practices that your father, your grandfather, and your grand-grandfather already used. For this reason, agricultural societies tend to be extremely reluctant to adopt new practices, and they look at novelties with distrust. Furthermore, agriculture is obviously cyclical. You are every year awaiting your new crop. Both these things bias agricultural societies towards a cyclical view of reality and history, and this as much in the realm of high as of low culture, whether that concerns the Confucian classics, the Rig Veda or the Hadith. Agrarian societies tend to hold the view that everything worthwhile has already been said by the classics, and that history is not so much evolving towards steadily higher perfection, as we now think, as rather is a constant repeat of circles. Take, for example, the dynastic cycles of China. Now, medieval Europe not only tended to think in circles too, so that, for example, the Holy Roman Empire was seen as a kind of replay of the Roman Empire, but was in addition permeated by what I'm tempted to call a deep inferiority complex towards classical antiquity. This is hard for us to fathom nowadays, but in the Middle Ages there was an all-pervasive sense that the world was in decline since Roman times. And there were actually obvious and good reasons for that, since Greek science or Roman medicine was not really overtaken until the 17th century. Now, European expansion actually started a bit earlier than is commonly thought. It started with the discovery of the Canary Islands in the 14th century and by the conquest in 1402, which I shall have more to say in a later lecture. This was the first time modern Europeans had clearly found something the Romans had never mentioned. But the thing was that what they had found was not very interesting. They had merely found a couple of sunny islands. Sunny, sure, but populated by a bunch of primitives in elite perceptions. All this added a bit to the legendary bestiary of medieval Europe, but it wasn't found terribly worthwhile. Later on, the Portuguese voyages to West Africa coincided precisely in time with the Italian Renaissance, but they had almost no impact on the Renaissance, because what the Portuguese had found were yet more primitive tribesmen from the elite perception. And even the Portuguese navigations to Asia made some impression, but they were sailing to lands after all, with which Europeans were, vaguely to be sure, familiar. For example, medieval Europeans had fake notions on how a crocodile, a hippopotamus or a rhino looked like. And it was interesting, but by no means earth-shaking, when the Portuguese presented a live rhino to Pope Leo V in 1515. I've never been able to figure out how the Portuguese had managed to ship that big and ill-tempered animal on a small sailing ship. They did, anyhow. Initially, Columbus' discoveries did not make that much of an impression either, as it at first appeared as if he had merely found yet more sunny islands populated by savages. They were all like the Canaries. They were merely further away. That began to change when by 1500 the Spaniards began to explore the coast of the mainland of America. And famously, Amerigo Vespucci was the first to claim they had stumbled on a large landmass, entirely unknown to the Romans. And not only on that, they also stumbled on plants and animals which were entirely unknown to classical zoology. You could thump your Lucretius on nature as much as you liked. These animals were surely not in it. Texts of that period are therefore full of expressions like, "This animal looks a bit like that animal, but not quite." Just imagine how you might describe a llama to somebody. It's a kind of donkey, but it has a long neck and a long hair. Actually, European illustrations of that period do their best to paint a llama, but it comes out as a very strange animal indeed. since the illustrators had clearly never been outside of Europe and they had to rely on some description. Or again, how would you describe a guinea pig? It's a kind of rat-like animal, but not quite. However, the big shock in my view was the discovery of the Aztecs. He was clearly a people with cities, ruling elite, writing, elaborate monumental structures, and anything else required to be titled a civilization. But it was a people that was never mentioned by the Romans. Not even, worse, found in the Bible. And further on, theologians therefore constantly struggled on how to place the Aztecs. Or indeed, how they got to America in the first place. For if all humans derived from Adam, where did the Native Americans fit in? The common view in that period was that they might be the lost seventh tribe of Israel, who might perhaps have wandered in some ways to the Americas. Some geographers already in the 16th century cleverly submitted that the Native Americans came from Asia, and that therefore there had to be a land bridge between Asia and America, the Europeans continued scouting for until the late 18th century. And critically, did the Aztecs not fit any Roman classification? But worse, while the Europeans had only fake knowledge of Africa, by 1530 Europe was truly inundated by knowledge of the Aztecs, as the Spanish, to tax them or to convert them, had also to thoroughly study them. In other words, by 1550 Europeans began to build up a comprehensive body of knowledge on a people and a nature on which classical texts could offer no guideline whatsoever. So, in what became known as the fight between the ancients and the moderns in the 16th and 17th century, in which the moderns argued that the modern age was clearly superior to antiquity, whereas the ancients continued to say that some Roman or Greek had always said or thought better than any modern, the moderns had the irrefutable argument of America on their side. However nobles the Romans were, the moderns had clearly surpassed them in knowledge. What this has done is to infuse Europe since the 16th century with the idea not only of modernity, a 16th century word by itself, but also with the idea that the present is irrefutably better than the past. And this was far less so in early modern China or in early modern Islam. The other impact on Europe came in the economic field. And it is here that I must finally introduce this difficult word, capitalism. Nobody exactly knows what capitalism is, in common with the rule that the more you talk about something, the more uncertain you become what it exactly is. It seems, however, to have two elements. First of all, it means gathering capital, to invest it in capital, to gain yet more capital. Clearly a different situation from that in ancient Rome, for example, where you gathered capital, bought supporters with that, and that brought you political leverage. And second, in capitalism, a laborer sells his labor power on a free market for labor. Furthermore, and here is the rub, such a situation must be seen by an entire society as desirable. For example, China surely had rich merchants, and Western Europeans had nothing to teach Chinese merchants in sophisticated techniques. In fact, you often find complaints in Portuguese sources from the 16th century that the Chinese were engaging in unfair business practices, an encoded way of saying that Chinese merchants were smarter than Portuguese ones. Yet this occurred within a society in which gathering money for money's sake was seen as dishonorable by the ruling elite. In Tokugawa Japan, similarly, merchants were classed as almost the lowest ranked profession, far lower than peasants, and lower still than geishas, and immediately after the very lowest of the low, actors. Surely this was a society with different values. In Tokugawa Japan, being a star classed you on the garbage collector. And so too, in many ways, being a capitalist, gathering money for money's sake, was still widely condemned in medieval Europe. In case I could adduce a painting by Hieronymus Bosch from 1500, The Death of the Scrooge. It is telling, I have to use an ancient, to my listeners likely an antique word, to describe what in medieval Europe was rated as a cardinal sin. Dante Alighieri placed them in the very lowest circles of the Inferno, namely, amassing money for the sake of acquiring more money. And particularly worth notice, very much worth eternal damnation, were those guilty of the even more cardinal sin, usury. Another antique word, which means charging more interest on a loan than the person to whom such a loan is given can afford, particularly if it comes to mortgages. In other words, while we nowadays bail usurers out, in the Middle Ages they would not only have ended up in prison, but likely be banished from the Holy Mother Church to await their eternal damnation. Now historians have waged an interminable discussion about the origins of capitalism, or, and that's not the same question, the origins of modern capitalism. These origins have variously, mostly dependent on where the author is from, been assigned to England in the 15th century, to the Netherlands in the 17th century, to Germany in the 16th century, and one writer even argues South Africa in the 17th century. Though, because it became linked with anti-Semitism in the Nazi period, an even older debate, whether capitalism was linked to European Jews, has more or less run out of steam. And finally, and that seems the obvious candidate, to Italy in the 13th century. However, that question need not detain us very long here. What does need emphasis is that Europe had by the 15th century already a quite powerful capitalist class, and in particular the Italian city-states had a very powerful capitalist class, and very much in particular that likely cradle of European capitalism, Genoa had. This place was more or less run by a bank on shares, administering the state's public debt and its finances. That was financed by share capital, the Banco di San Giorgio. Now, how much more capitalist can you get? It's as if the US budget is managed by Goldman Sachs. To that extent, capitalism was nothing new, and was much, much older than the 16th century. If you really have to trace back its origins in time, you likely have to go back all the way back to the 11th century. And if you want a date when capitalism began, it might be 1176, when the picked forces of Emperor Barbarossa, the very emblem of feudal pride, were defeated by the Italian cities in the Battle of Legnano, which ensured their permanent independence from the emperor. Furthermore, at least in Western Europe at the 16th century, the old manorial system, basically that was a closed economy where the peasants worked part of their time on their own land and had to work part of their time on the land of their landlords, had by and large withered away. Most labor in Europe was now wage labor, while the peasants had to pay rent by and large in cash. Furthermore, in many places where the manorial system still subsisted, places like Sicily or the Alentejo in Portugal, lords of the manor were producing marketable goods to sell in big cities. And in Sicily, a striking case, the landlords were virtually owned by Genoese moneylenders, who were in turn linked to the great merchant houses of Genoa. Yet all this occurred within a still largely pre-capitalist environment. The idea, even in the 16th century, was that you wanted to become rich, to buy first an entitlement to nobility, then acquire land, and then for the next generation might live the life of a noble in the countryside, where you would try to disguise in any way that your nobility was perhaps bought 50 years ago. Rather, you would now fabricate an elaborate heraldic tree, tracing your family, who might actually have been cobblers or shoemakers, back to the very old family of the realm, preferably going back somewhere to the 8th century. Historians call this, in a nice term, the betrayal of the bourgeoisie. It has not disappeared in Europe nowadays. The Rothschilds, for example, are now the Baron de Rothschild, while the German steel barons Flick are now a member of the Spanish nobility. But it was certainly more prevalent in the 16th century, when mere merchants were still deeply despised by the nobility, and where, for example, Genoese bankers all wanted to become nobles who lived off estates in the countryside of Liguria or in Nice, such as one such family, the Grimaldis, who have very well succeeded in that, as they are nowadays of the hereditary dukes of the Duchy of Monaco. Now, economic historians are nowadays extremely reluctant to admit any influence of the discoveries and broader of non-European trade on the economic development of Europe. The European non-European periphery was peripheral to Europe, as historian Patrick O'Brien sums this view up. This is partly undeniable. The trade to the Baltic, for example, yearly involved some 1,000 ships. That of South America at best 50, that to Asia at best 10. Again, in the late 16th century, all colonial trade accounted for about a quarter of Portuguese state revenues, despite all the attempts of the Portuguese crown to milk it, and that Portugal was the country most dependent on colonial trade. The revenue from salt pens was nearly as important as all that colonial trade. However, this does not tell the whole story. To make a contemporary comparison, the biggest concern in the USA nowadays is not dynamic Microsoft, but humble Walmart, a supermarket chain for non-US listeners. And most fortune is not really gained in web designing, as rather from very humble pursuits, retailing of food. But web designing is surely more glamorous, and it does attract high-risk venture capital and makes higher profit than retailing. Similarly so, in the 16th century, long distance, and particularly colonial trade, was in that period the equivalent to modern high-tech, in a very literal sense, since the sailing ships used in the transatlantic, let alone the Asian trade, were very complicated machines that needed great technical skill to handle. But also, as the colonial trade was the most glamorous route of trade, it thus attracted a great deal of high-risk venture capital. For of course, since certainly in the trade to Asia, it would take at least 2 years before you saw any return to your money, only very wealthy people could invest in it. Whereas, if you invested in trade between, say, Amsterdam and the Baltic, that would perhaps take 2 or 4 months, and often too, colonial trade yielded high profits. The discoveries boosted European capitalism in several ways. First of all, they created new demand, or they increased the demand for an old product. Whether that be the demand for tobacco in the 16th century, or for iPads nowadays, capitalism, after all, always needs to create demands for new products. I will return to this in the next lecture. Suffice it to say that the discoveries either created a demand for entirely new products, that the discoveries created a demand for entirely new products, not only in Europe, but in Asia and the Americas as well. In Mexico, in the 17th century, people's ranks were, for example, delimited by clothing. The Indians wore completely Indian dress. Mestizos might wear European style dress, which was, however, all locally made. Elite Spaniards, however, wore the most expensive clothing. and all that clothing had to be imported from Europe, and more precisely from Flanders, which by that time had entirely specialized on Latin American markets. So much so that by 1700, employment in the Flemish countryside, where most of these textiles were woven, almost entirely depended on the demand from Latin America. Second, it created a massive demand for credit. For basically, what the Spanish and the Portuguese crown did was to use American and Asian riches as pawn to finance hugely expensive foreign policy, the money of which was lent to the crown by private banks. At first, these were two banks from the German town of Augsburg, a town which in the 15th century had thrived on the proceeds of copper and gold mines in the Tyrol, which were, as said, critical for the trade to Africa, namely the firm of Bartholomeus Welser and that of Jacobus Fugger, the rich one, as he was known, who with huge donations to the German princes bought the election of King Charles I of Castile to Holy Roman Emperor in 1519. He basically bribed anybody, from the lowest imperial knight to the most loftiest of electors. Fugger afterwards justly boasted he had bought the imperial crown, and Charles I the title of Charles V, and he afterwards more or less ran the finances of the Habsburgs' dominions in reward. After the abdication of Charles V, when the Fuggers bankrupt and retreated to their estate in the South German countryside, the German capitalists became increasingly wary of further investments in Spain. So that, after 1557, their role was taken over by Genoa, one of the three major Italian city-states. The merchants and bankers of Genoa had originally specialized in trade to the eastern Mediterranean, but as all their former colonies there were taken by the Tatars and the Ottomans, they increasingly fostered attention to the expanding Spanish Empire in the Atlantic. To secure their investments, Genoa's merchants and bankers had more or less to accept a Spanish protectorate over the city, unlike Venice, which remained independent and hostile to Spain. And the Spanish were therefore also far less willing to let Genoa's Venetian competitors in the New World business. Portugal was traditionally more linked to Florence than it was to Genoa. At any rate, Genoese bankers or branches of Genoese merchant houses were by 1540 increasingly financing almost all of Spain's trade to the Americas. They farmed the revenues of state-run mines, and as the Germans retreated from business, the Genoese moved in. By 1580, backed as much by American silver as by the Spanish, or rather the Castilian tercios, that in that period dominated any European battlefield, the Genoese had constructed a quiet engine for financial dominance over all of Western Europe, along an axis of financial exchanges that basically ran along the old Lotharingian axis, and that stretched from the main Spanish exchange at Medina del Campo, via Lyon in France, through to Germany's main exchange, Frankfurt am Main, and then on to Northern Europe's financial metropolis, Antwerp. Though Antwerp and the entire system had few links with the Baltic, and this was a major weakness of the system, it all converged on the fairs in the small Italian town Piacenza, where a small, discreet set of bankers converged yearly to arrange interest rates and rates for drafting bills of exchange all over Western Europe, and thus arranged too the distribution of American silver across Europe and from the Americas to Europe. This Genoese-controlled European economy of the 16th century had three major weaknesses, and they were eventually to bring it down. First of all, while the Genoese set the tone in Madrid, They had traditionally been excluded from Lisbon, where the crown partly used Florentine bankers and merchants, partly ran the trade through government monopoly, where goods were sold by crown merchants. A government monopoly that was backed by a consortium of Portuguese merchants, mainly Maranos, that is Jews practicing the Jewish religion indoors, the Catholic religion outdoors. Second, this system had, as said, few or no ties with the Baltic, where the Hanseatic cities and the merchants from the northern Netherlands, particularly from Amsterdam, dominated. And the whole Genoese system got into few difficulties when, after 1590, both Spain and Italy faced a prolonged series of famines and had to procure ever more grain from the Baltic, for which they could only rely on their Dutch enemies. Third, and most obviously, as this system depended on the solvency of the Spanish crown, it got into severe difficulties when the crown got enmeshed in a whole series of state bankruptcies, which the most famous one was that of 1575, when the Spanish crown declared itself officially insolvent and was thus unable to finance its army in Flanders, who were fighting the Dutch Republic. This ensued in a mutiny of the Spanish troops, who on 4 November, under the slogan Santiago, España, a sangre, a carne, a fuego, a saco, for Santiago, for Spain, butcher, massacre, burn, pillage, towards Antwerp. Arguably, one of the most important events in European history, as it not only caused all the rich merchants of Antwerp to forsake Antwerp for Amsterdam, and despite the whole nationalist Dutch literature arguing the contrary, that was the critical factor to explain the Dutch miracle of the 17th century, but as it also caused the cities of the southern Netherlands to align with the rebelling cities of the northern Netherlands, and the defeat of the Netherlands was very, very close. Had the Spaniards defeated the Dutch revolt, England would not have held out for much longer either, in which case we would probably all be speaking Spanish by now. As the Genoese began to retreat from running the Spanish trade and the Spanish state revenues, their role was in turn taken over by the Lisbon bankers, who had become rich by trade in Oriental commodities, and who were, as I said, mostly Maranos. By 1630, therefore, the great cause of the Counter-Reformation in Europe, at the very height of the Thirty Years' War, was being financed by a consortium of Jews, most of whom were resident in, or had at least very close ties, to Amsterdam. Money does not smell. The finances of the greatest champion of the Catholic cause in the Thirty Years' War, Wallenstein, were also run by a Protestant Dutch banker, Hans de Witte, who used banks all over Protestant and Catholic Europe to draw in money for the Catholic cause, for which Wallenstein used his estates all over Bohemia as collateral. By 1630, the Dutch really did not need a Piet Hein anymore, on whom I shall have more to say in the next lecture, because all American silver was now being weighed on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, or more precisely, on the Amsterdam Central Bank for fixing the exchange rates, the Wisselbank, which in the 17th and 18th century had a somewhat similar position as the Fed has nowadays, as it decided on interest and exchange rates all over Europe. Thus, by the 1620s, as the economies of particularly southern Europe began to get increasingly the economic difficulties, the economic focus of Europe shifted to the north, to the Netherlands, and then on to Britain, where Spain, Portugal, and to some extent Italy, fell into the limelight. To some extent, because there are two sides to this. As I've said already, this depression particularly hit Venice, which furthermore faced a long and extremely costly war with the Ottoman Empire for the control of Crete. That ruined the Serene Republic, as it called itself. And yet, Phoenician merchants now increasingly retreated to rural estates in the countryside. And while by 1700 the trade of Venice was moribund, if not dead already, they ran these agricultural latifundia on the best capitalist lines. Agricultural laborers on Phoenician estates were supervised by overseers with clocks in their hand to time how much time they spent on each task, as in the best modern factory. And they also derived huge profits from these estates. Some of that money they invested abroad. Most of it they laid out on culture. Most economists would probably deem that extremely counterproductive.
Yet, if you make a boat trip along the Canal Grande, it merits notice that almost all palazzi there were built in the 17th and 18th centuries. And surely, no museum in Europe or in the USA is complete without its Canaletto paintings, depicting a scene from the elegant life of Venice that was the envy of all of Europe in the 18th century. That Venice became Europe's main tourist attraction, already by the 18th century, was primarily due to a conscious choice of the Phoenician merchants and bankers to invest in peasantry and culture. And European capitalists might well be advised to follow their far-sighted policy now too, as the whole continent will likely become a tourist attraction park for East Asian, South American, and maybe even African visitors by the mid-21st century.